Welcome to Performance Day's Functional Fabric Fair podcast. You are listening to a sustainability presentation from April 2015. Ms. Pamela Ravasio, CSR and Sustainability Manager of European Outdoor Group, presents Sustainability in Innovation.
Good afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me all right? Okay, so in case I speak too quick, do let me know. I'm used to have mostly British people around me, even though I'm Swiss originally, so I kind of tend to be a bit on the quick side. Thank you for coming here, and it's really a pleasure to be here at Performance Days and presenting this piece of work. What I would like to do today is a bit walk of a rich, but let me get started of who the European Outdoor Group is. The European Outdoor Group is a membership association. We're just short of 70 brands, most of which are internationally operating European outdoor brands, but we also do have some retailers, as we just very recently opened up to retailers, and who knows, maybe going forward, even manufacturers. We also have associate members, which are national organizations, so in a sense, we're kind of a pyramid system in the worst and the best of all senses. But the reason why I'm here today is that I would like to try and walk a ridge between what usually is perceived as something very positive, innovation, looking forward-looking, new things coming in, getting stuff done, and sustainability, which in many cases is always still considered as a hurdle and something not so nice. In German, there's a very lovely term, the muesli image, so very alternative gray, but nothing attractive to it. To start there, I would like to revert back to something that is habitually done for big companies, but then also governments often do. And what they do is scenario research and scenario building. So what they do is they really look very consistently, do a lot of work into how will the world look like in, say, 2045, 2050, 2060. They use statistical models, they do focus groups. They analyze the way technologies has evolved over the last 50, 60 years. And out of that, they compile things, pieces of research specific to industries, but then often used, as I said, for governments, for infrastructure. And one such piece of research, as you see here, is how New York could look like in 2100, according to a piece of research shown in The Crystal in London, supposedly one of the most, or the most sustainable building in the world as of today, and a piece of research done by Siemens. Now, the funny thing is, if you look at that, that is reality. That is Masdar, a zero carbon city. And surprisingly, it doesn't look that different from a scenario which is totally virtual, totally modeled, but for 2100. So the question is, well, innovation, sustainability, how do they relate to one another? And hence the title of my presentation, Pain, Pleasure, or Necessity. But let me dig a bit further into this whole thing. How could the world look like? Research is all nice and well, but actually the images is where it gets really interesting and fascinating, in my opinion. Of course, there are those influences. We know that population is growing older, that population is growing. We know that there's an issue around petrol. We know that we're trying desperately to get more petrol out of the ground. We do know that we will have a problem with healthcare, the way we manage ourselves today. That's all nice and well, but that's not where it gets really plastic. What if, though, if Asia would become today's Europe? If the craftsmanship we have today in Europe, say, to work leather, to make things from our hands, suddenly started migrating east. When we here become the cheap labor of experts that migrates east to get jobs in China, when the Chinese supply chain isn't the Chinese supply chain because they have relocated to Africa, way cheaper to source there, what would happen? Well, a few things that could happen. Obviously, not only that we start migrating east, but certainly where now Chinese brands just started to try and get to the old continent Europe, Chinese brands, and in high fashion this has already happened, they become status symbols. Certainly these would be the brands that we would want to have, and not the Pradas and the Guccis of our days. It could very well be Shanghai Chan going forward. What would it be? Or certainly we've got local African influences in fabrics and technology and fibers, something that today is as good as irrelevant. Certainly there's an African market to sell cheap goods to that produces for themselves. What if Asia became Europe of today? Well, it is happening. These are the retail numbers for Asia. And the interesting thing, though, if we look east in China and Vietnam and Cambodia and these kind of countries, is the fact that for them, sustainability isn't about doing good for the planet or for people. It's a security and safety issue. It's actually a health and safety issue for their survival. Point being, a couple of years ago, there was a milk scandal where powdered milk for children was basically being poisoned. It created a massive hysteria, people migrating down to Hong Kong, paying about 40 times the base price for milk powder, sometimes spending as much as 100 times their monthly salary to stack up on a year's worth their yearly supply. This is reality, and it's not so far off of what could potentially happen on a much larger scale. And to raise the next question, what if everyone would become a maker? These two pictures here are from the Paris Couture Fashion Week 2014, February, and are 3D printed. They're totally on sale. They cost about 20,000 euros the piece, but they can be printed at any given time. And the question again, how far off are we? Because those amongst you who have kids, they know that you give them a mobile phone and they tell you how to use the mobile phone. You give them a CAD system, they will build you the prototype to the toy they want to have 3D printed. If we roll back time to when I was a kid, that is the beginning of the 80s, mid-80s, mobile phone, that was something that very rich executives had, and you could roll it around in a suitcase that was about 20 kilo a piece. No one ever would have imagined that we'd be going around in the internet surfing and shopping via our mobile phones. So just imagine how much could actually change in this aspect in the next 20 years, now that technology has gotten onto that bandwagon of electronification and digitalization. Power of brands is again the question that comes here. Well, if we print 3D, why would a brand still have its own supply chains and goods and own brand stores? I can print my own in the backyard, why would I buy? Might a brand potentially sell himself or herself rather through the IP? Patents. Models being downloaded and you have agreements with local manufacturers to get your stuff done. And Adidas designing in Germany, but maybe printing in Southern Africa through a neighborhood printing service. How far off are we really of that? Because I can buy a 3D printer for 500-600 euros these days. Not very much. Another if that I would like to throw out, and is, well, what if we wouldn't buy to own? What if we would primarily share? There are a number of reasons why that could be of relevance. Those that have observed fiber prices over the last 6 or 7 years have seen that, yes, they have come down a little bit, but they have not reverted back to the level of 2005 and 2006. So this applies to cotton as much as to polyester. The prices for garments are going down, but if we look at the manufacturer's price index, sorry, what manufacturers pay for their fabrics and their manufacturing, it's actually gone up in absolute terms. Again, the question is, what is it that we're looking at, and where is the trend going? And if you just look at all those brands that I'm listing here. There's shared fashion, shared accessories, shared tools, shared cars, shared houses, literally everything you can imagine. And this is just the start of it. This pictures of stuff that has been around for the last 2, 3, 4 years. And we know now that at least a year, 18 months ago in the UK, a UK study judged the European sharing economy to be worth at least $500 million already. So where could that potentially be going if there's more happening? We know we raid each other's wardrobes already. I mean, those that have teenage girls know exactly how attractive their wardrobe, their own wardrobe is for their teenage girls. Teenage girls these days share wardrobes between them because it's a lot cooler. You can change much easier, as you say, if you're a budget, and hang on, lo and behold, you'll be able to buy brands that no way you could buy otherwise. And in a similar way, when it comes to sharing, if we look at where we are now and the big problems we face in healthcare, it immediately raises the issue, well, sharing is something that is cool amongst the youngs right now because, yes, it's the teenagers that share wardrobes, that share gadgets because they can't afford it. But the reality is that society is moving. And we do know that by 2020 and 2030, the bell curve of age will have moved considerably, which will mean that in Europe, we'll be an old society. In contrast, in Asia, where it is a very, very young society right now, we'll just have moved more to what we would think an average society, a society of professionals. Again, it reflects on how they're going to be able to spend money. Professional societies in their 30s, primarily, they have a fair amount of disposable money. Aging societies don't have much money on their disposals. In contrast, they are spending or maintaining their society in more or less good shape. And just to take these examples here, the reason why I've taken them and why it's relevant is these are record holders. The oldest man to climb Mount Everest, the oldest woman to swim the channel between France and Britain, and the oldest person ever to run a marathon at 102 years of age. So the youngest one is actually the lady. The gentleman climbing Mount Everest is in his late 80s, early 90s, and then we get to 102 on Mount Everest. So this is not something that I've went out to look for. It's like, yes, these are extremes, but if you look at, for instance, who runs a London Marathon, you will see that there's a considerable amount of people that do run the London Marathon and are well into their retired age. And frankly, I haven't run a marathon because I'm not sure I'm getting to the end of it. So there's a huge respect for these people, but it actually shows that, no, we're not just retiring and then that's end and over. For a lot of people, that's where life will start. Which again raises yet another question right in that realm. What if outdoors just means being outside? Because today's youngsters have grown up with the digitalization. Many don't really leave home very much anymore. Leaving your home to go to the playground, to go to, in the UK, it's called sort of the adventure parks where you climb around, to just go swim once in a while in the river nearby, to camp out at the back of your house, just testing what it means to use a tent. All that is really adventurous for a lot of the settings we encounter these days. And as a matter of fact, if we look around, is it really so far that we need to think 2050? I can tell you from an outdoor perspective that, in fact, this is one of the biggest challenges that we're facing. We don't sell the biggest part of our products anymore at the top edge of performance, meaning few of the people that really are, that consider themselves outdoorsy, climb Mount Everest, but they will go for long walks with their dogs, they will cycle, they will camp out maybe a couple of 3 days a year in the Lake District or in the Swiss mountains. And this is basically the generation that we're growing up with, or that I'm going to grow old with. It's the go monkey, it's the glamping, glamorously camping. It's Mount Fuji at 5:30 or 4 o'clock in the morning, depending on the time of the year, where you've got hundreds of people queuing up to see the sunrise. They're the best equipped people in the world I've seen on mass spaces, frankly. They spend €1,000 a piece easily on an outdoor jacket. All they ever get as outdoors is to go to Mount Fuji, which frankly is a pedestrian highway, even though it's at 3,600 meters height. Parkour, climbing in London City, but then also, this used to be at some point just a way, a hiking path up a Japanese mountain. It came down in a landslide, and that's what they built. You can roll up there in a wheelchair. That is considered outdoors these days. So why am I bringing this up? Why does this matter, and what does it have to do with sustainability? It matters because everything going forward, our whole lives, move within a finite system. Finite systems mean that all resources are limited, and that doesn't mean anything in particular other than just exactly that. It just happens that all the resources we use in some way or another rely on what we get out of our environment. Sadly, we've really pushed the boundaries to a level where it's not recoverable. We know that from science, and for anyone that is scientifically inclined, go have a look at that paper. It's kind of oldish already, 2009, that's nearly 6 years ago. That's very old for science. But it's a scientific proof that we will not see a world anymore how we've known it. We know it's going to be changing. The question is just how. Because the thing is here, we know it's going to be changing, but we don't know how and how exactly that's going to be panning out for our brands. However, consumers rely on you as a brand. They rely on you as a quality, as their quality, to guarantee their quality of life. And if you manage to bind your consumer, your end consumer, to have that personal relationship with them, that they tag along, whatever it is that you will present them, that they believe in you being useful for them to live their life, then you have something to look forward to. And someone that has made that, managed to do that really well, and that's why the picture is here, is Nestlé with their Nespressos. They invented a product that no one needed, that is priced at 20 times the price you get of coffee in a normal pack, and a pack of Nespresso, judged by the kilo, is about €200, a normal pack is about 10. That creates waste. Yes, it is convenient, but they've gone from creating capsules to ranges of machines to crockery to interior design, you name it. And those that have bought into the system just tag along because they believe in that is the added value that they need in their lives. Nespresso could decide to turn into an outdoor brand going forward, and believe me, they would manage to drag their consumers with them. What I would like to have a look with you here is just examples of how different companies and different projects have taken the challenges they've encountered. Some of them are commercial, some of them are given by their buyers, some of them are just by looking at their own business models and what they've come up with. This one here is very, you would say, traditional. And it actually comes from the US and Canada. REI, a mountain equipment co-op, some years ago started having to pay for each poly bag that they would get into their stores. Naturally, they wouldn't want to pay whatever amount of small cents it was per bag because they would turn over something like 5 or 6 million poly bags every year. They wanted to have that reduced. And there's good big super brands in the retail space, they would obviously outsource that to their brands that they're buying in. Now, in this case, this is a brand called Prana that redesigned the way they package. You see in the top, let me see if that works, how it was before, the ways that they created, and this is what they've done. Basically, they just rolled it up in sushi style and started to ship differently. Not only did that save 500,000 poly bags in the first year, equivalent to about $150,000 for the retailer, they managed to ship more in less space and hence create added savings. To the point of that retailers like REI and Mountain Equipment Corp basically require all their brands to ship like that, if possible at all. Another added value, when you take that stuff up here in the retail space, you have to unpack and stack new. You get it shipped like that, you don't need to. You save time in retail, how you present stuff, and it remains nicer. Another one, and I absolutely adore this one. This is a small jeans brand from the north of Wales in a town. It's called Hyth Denim, as you can see. In a town where Marks and Spencer's about 30 years used to own a factory or produce in a factory with 400 employees. The factory went under when everything was shipped to Asia. And 3.5 years ago, this small brand started with 2 people to produce again. They have 15 people now. But what is actually a lot more interesting is they're really at the cutting edge of how they engage with their consumers. It's a club. It is really that niche feel of, I don't want to buy, I want to be part of that. I want to see how my jeans are being made. So just a few examples here. The lady that has sewn the jeans from A to Z, not just the leg, but really from A to Z, signs the jeans. Limited runs, all numbered, from 1 to 20. The best fabric that you can get in jeans shipped in from Japan. They do clubs, no wash clubs. Everyone heard of don't wash your jeans 6 months? Well, they've got a club you can sign up to with a pledge, and people think it's cool. They sell to an amount that, and these are not cheap jeans, they sell for around €300 a piece. And they've gone from success to success. If you want to learn how to do sustainability communications really cool, that's the place to go to. But then there's also the more, I would say, corporate way of doing that. And there's nothing wrong with that. Because if you're a big corporation, that's probably what you need to do. Because you face a certain amount of complexity that there's no other way of how to approach that. And this is an example of a multi-brand holding that really have gone to a long way to really do an in-depth risk assessment, match it against what is happening on a global level. And what you get out of that is this matrix. And it's a thorough job, and it will change a lot of things in a corporation that is otherwise fairly complex. No, they will never be cutting edge, and they will never be the absolute best in class. But they will know exactly where they get the biggest bang for the buck, and they will thoroughly change their supply chains and where they need to do it. Not everything of that will change to be 100% perfect, but where they invest the money, that's where they're going to be really good at. And then last, but certainly not least, this is really daring approach. It's one example. There are many others out there. This one I've taken because many of you will know this material. Teijin years ago had a very deep look at their factory and the way they produce and what they produce. And the result they came to is, well, their whole business is based on petrol. Lo and behold, petrol is not exactly a future-oriented material if we think of to the lengths we have to go these days. And they said, well, we don't know how to solve the problem, but we will have to solve the problem. And they started working on a system that is EcoCircle now, where they can go back to the polymer state and recycle polyester. There are others out there. I've got a colleague there from Torres standing in the back. Is an eco company there. There are many others. There are just two of many that really go to the length and say, guys, we can't do it that way. We have to create the difference. Because if we just do what we kept doing for the last 150 years, like many of those companies are, they've been very successful for the better part of a century. Surprises can happen. And they do. So pain, pleasure, or necessity. This is the big question I started off with. And I'm tempted to say more than it either being pain or pleasure or a necessity is actually an opportunity. It's an opportunity to really define the market, define the consumers you want to have, and define your products anew. Yes, it's not without work, it's not without risk, but it certainly has got an opportunity. Because, well, the world going forward is never going to be looking like it's looked in the past. And like the frogs in the pan when it gets slowly comfortable. Why should we, feeling comfortable where we are, jump out of the window where it's just bloody cold out there and so uncomfortable? Right now, all is good, all is comfortable. Why is there a need to change? Right now we're bathing at 42 degrees. But those that have been in a Japanese hot bath, they know that it can change very quick and might have a deja vu there. This can go very quick. And there are a few assumptions I would like to question how things have actually changed and we've not realized before I go and have a look a bit more at a very specific example of how we've approached that in the wool sector on getting something started or working with others to start change happening. When we think of retail, we always think of brick and mortar. So you walk into a retail shop, you tell the clerk what you want to do or want to have, and you get some suggestions, and that you might walk with out of the store with them, or you might go somewhere completely else because it hasn't satisfied your demand. The reality looks very different these days. And this doesn't even take into account the fact that you actually don't rely on the media primarily, but on your colleagues. So if your daughter, your friend, someone you know really well and has experience in sports, in running, in cycling, you will ask that person for recommendations and trust that you get a good recommendation. This is not even considered here. So the whole thing has come so disorganized, so multifaceted. It's nothing like it used to be, and yet we have this very monolithic idea of what things are. Or that one. Do you really think that someone that gets up at 6 o'clock in the morning to run 90 minutes for 15 kilometers is in for the experience? Those that run a marathon? I don't think so. It's actually to show off. It is to be able to say, hey guys, I've run 15K this morning before coming to work. It is about running a marathon for charity and raising 2,000-4,000 euros. This is really what it's all about. So vision and measures, how do you get to implement sustainability and activities around that? That's where I now will go and take the examples of what we've done or tried to do and try to collaborate with at the OG. Ultimately, never forget, it's always just about you and your business. So my solution is not the same as her solution, is not going to be the same as their solution. It will completely look different from yours. There are always two parts to it. One thing is looking at what the problems are. And then the second part is, well, how can you start to bridge the gap from where you are now to where you need to go? So where are we now when it comes to innovation? And I take, with the theme of this fair, wool, as an example, and for a simple reason. Wool and outdoor has seen a two-digit growth in the last few years in outdoor. It's a material that in the past never was much appreciated in outdoor. And it's changing very rapidly. There are brands who used to do thermals, they would say synthetics all my life or nothing else. And these days, lo and behold, you look at the ingredients that they use and there's a substantial percentage of wool. So what happens with wool, it is what we would call a risk material. And what is a risk material? It's a material where the supply chain isn't totally identified, so you cannot be 100% sure whether that bale of wool that you get really comes from that specific farm in Australia and on that specific farm from the lot that was sheared in summer or in spring 2014 and from that specific sheep. You cannot. The system is set up to the extent that this is as good as impossible. So the analysis that we've done is that the context is really that we use more and more wool in outdoor. Mostly merino, but there's some rare breeds that are coming in for other uses. For a variety of applications, it used to be base layers, but the longer the more also medium layers, outer layers. So the variety is growing. And at the same time, there are the traceability issues, the NGOs that get to breathe down our necks with quite radical pictures, as you can see here. And this is just the least of it all, really. It's like you can have a lot more graphic stuff than that. It's difficult to digest on some occasions. At the same time, you do have things like this. So individual brands or supply chains that really start to play with that fact that, hey, we can trace our stuff back to the actual source. Now, when you think of NGOs, always take into consideration us in outdoor, we live off the pristinity of the environment. We live off the fact that the mountains look as pretty as they are. And it does us very bad service is if there's a massive paradox in between how we really source our stuff and what people perceive us being as an industry. So that does a real disservice. Another added risk that few really see that way, but this is a very tangible thing. So what we've gone to do, before I go into, there's another aspect. I was talking about the traceability and the complexity of supply chains, and this is just panning one out, and you see it's not only fairly deep, it's like on two occasions here, there are auctions, meaning bales and bales are just jumbled together, bought off by the quality. You don't know whether they come from A, B, and C. And then to make matters worse, later in the washing cycle and scouring, they're often chucked in with each other again by quality. And you completely lose track of where stuff is coming from. You wouldn't be able to tell if it's Australia, if it's China, if it's New Zealand by the time it's getting washed. So we were looking for a means by which we could address the risk that we saw. But then taking into account that most of our brands are small, and I'm saying really small, you know, they might have anything from 10, 20, 50 employees to maybe 100 employees, but they're not multinationals. They don't have the clout of multinationals, and yet we needed something that is workable. So this is where, with that baseline, we looked at what we could and what we couldn't do and what was happening globally. And then it turned out that there was a development in the makes, which was the responsible wool standard from Textile Exchange, which isn't finished at this point. And Ashley sitting there will talk more about how they work and the standard, how they develop in specific, for specifically. But that's where we saw the opportunity of closing that gap of the risk that we saw today and where a whole industry was trying to move to. And with the small brands and a standard like this, this is where we can see, we contribute our knowledge of how small brands operate, the clout they have, the problems they see, how they can or can't address them. And then there's an organization that makes sure that the quality that comes out of that is stringent enough to apply not just to small brands, but actually where the bigger problem is in the whole supply chain, something that is scalable, that technically a big multinational could use should they decide to really go down the line of wanting to know where their stuff is coming from and guaranteeing a quality level in animal welfare and in land management. There's a reason why I choose, and here comes a plug for us in outdoor, and there's a reason why I chose this specific brand to illustrate this. And this is because, one, it's the growth in wool usage that is represented by this brand, is Ottowox here from Germany, but also the use of mixed types of wools. There's merino in there, there's rare breeds from Switzerland there, part of which is totally traceable, another part is where they've basically built their own supply chain to go around and addressing that risk of not knowing where stuff is coming from and how the animals might or might not be treated. And with a brand like this in mind, who's a really small brand in global context, we have gone about to really try and think, what can we learn from a brand like this? How we can bring that to other brands, and how can we then bring that to the bigger industry as a whole so that the result can again be taken back into outdoor and our brands and give a tool to make it as easy as possible in our brands. And with that, if you want to ask questions, very happy to take some. Otherwise, thank you very much for being here, for listening to this talk. Feel free to drop me a line anytime. I'm usually based in Kendal in the Lake District, but I'm often traveling, so by all means, do let me know, and happy to catch up one by one. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Performance Day's Functional Fabric Fair podcast. To get your free ticket for the next fair or listen to other presentations, go to www.performancedays.eu. Copyright April 2015 by Design and Development GmbH Textile Consult. All rights are reserved.